KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today, I'm very excited to have our Professor Edward Lee, who is the author of the book The Fight for the Future, How People Defeated Hollywood and Saved the Internet for Now. And this is a book that Ed has written focusing on the literally the step-by-step and all the players and events that led to the defeat of the Stop Online Piracy Act a couple of years ago. SOPA, as it came to be known, and its compatriot in the other chamber in Congress, PIPA, became really the touchstones for current battles involving not only the Internet itself and what information would be available on the Internet, but more specifically what copyright law would actually be in that area. Now, KZSU, of course, is at Stanford University in Stanford, California, in the heart of Silicon Valley, and Stanford is part and a center in that focus. So many of the listeners to Hearsay Culture, both because you are in traffic in the Bay Area and also because you've listened to the show and also because you've paid attention to current events, are familiar with SOPA and PIPA. What you might not be familiar with are all of the players and people and organizations that came together in this really unheard-of coalition to fight this legislation. Now, by way of immediate disclosure, I was part of that enormous group. My small part was that I co-authored a letter with Professor Mark Lemley from Stanford and David Post from Temple that was signed by over 100 IP professors and took a very strong position against SOPA and PIPA for several reasons, including speech and the impact on the domain name system on the Internet. But, as you know, from listening to Hearsay Culture, this show is not about me, and so I mention that merely to let everyone know that I did take a strong position against SOPA and PIPA, but the focus, as you know from listening to the show, is not me or my work, but rather, in this case, Professor Lee's book. So, the disclaimer being done, we are going to have this discussion where we take a walk through this history that Ed has very meticulously outlined for us with background interviews and information that really, I even though I was involved in it, I wasn't familiar with, and get very deep into this discussion to figure out what parties were there and what we can really take from these events. For those of you that aren't familiar with Ed's work, he's a professor of law and a director of the program in intellectual property law at IIT Chicago Kent College of Law. He's a graduate of William College and a cum laude graduate from Harvard Law School. I know Ed's work, actually, and this is maybe a little bit more of a disclosure. I know Ed's work from when I was a fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford, where Ed and I were part of a group of people that worked on some appellate briefs involving copyright issues. So I met Ed very briefly at that point, but I've become, over that time, very familiar with his work. He's written a number of influential articles on speech and copyright and issues related to those areas. He, in fact, was at the Center for Internet Society, I think prior to when I was there, working on the infamous Eldred case, as well as Golan v. Holder, which is a case that I also worked on effectively in a junior associate role, if you will, doing work on those briefs. He writes for Huffington Post and a variety of other outlets, and he is joining us from his office in Chicago via Skype. Ed, thank you much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Dave, for having me.
So I mentioned your background, but it would be helpful, I think, if you talk a little bit more about your background and why you came to focus on SOPA.
Well, it's actually a very interesting story how I got hooked into this topic. If you look at my prior writing, you refer to some of them just now. You know, I do have a general interest in internet policy and issues related to copyright and free speech. Yet at the time that the debate over the Stop Online Piracy Act or SOPA was going on, to be honest, I was not a part of the opposition. I was not, or the supporters of SOPA for that matter. I was on the sidelines evaluating the arguments, and at the time that the debate was going on, I actually thought it was a very complicated issue. So I did not sign the letter, the great letter that you helped draft that had 100 law professors. that I think was an important part of the debate that focused on the First Amendment. But there was another competing memo out there by Floyd Abrams that was taking the position that SILPA would not create any First Amendment problems. So if you fast forward a little bit until the end of the debate, afterwards, I was invited by Alfred Perry of then Paramount Pictures to talk on a panel related to what happened in the protests against SILPA and how SILPA had been defeated. Paramount Pictures was basically making... Paramount Pictures, of course, supported SILPA and the efforts to clamp down on online piracy. So it was coming off of the loss that it had in this debate over SILPA. And as a kind of olive branch, it was reaching out to a number of law schools around the country to talk to law and students about what happened in the debate and what their views were and why they held those views. You know, so I was privileged enough to be invited to speak on SILPA at University of Wisconsin with Al Perry and another professor. For that panel discussion, I had to do a lot of research related to what happened leading up to the protest, or the famous part about the protest was when Wikipedia blacked out its website, as well as over 100,000 other websites blacked out on January 18th, 2012. So just a little bit over 2 years ago, as a form of protest against SOPA. So to get ready for that panel at University of Wisconsin, I basically had my research assistant go back in time, and we created a timeline of what happened in the debate. And that's the moment when basically I realized how important what had happened was in terms of our copyright debate, in terms of our democratic debate about political issues. Really, for the first time in our 200 years of copyright law, we saw, you know, millions of people get involved, or the masses, the public masses, get involved in what used to be a very arcane area specialized for lawyers and legislators primarily. So, you know, doing the research for this panel discussion, and I should mention, you know, Alfred Perry was great on the panel, and it was an open discussion, honest discussion, I think, and that helped to sort of spark my interest in recreating or telling the story about what had happened. And then the final thing I'll say about sort of why I became interested in writing about this topic is that even at that moment, when I really became attracted to writing the story of SOPA, to be honest, I only scratched the surface, because when I ended up interviewing people related to the protests, I learned a lot more that wasn't reported in the news. And, you know, that basically after each interview of people who were involved in the debate, I just felt like the story was even more incredible. And there were so many things that needed to be captured for history for people to study later on. And, you know, based on those interviews, I at some point developed a certain amount of responsibility. I felt a certain amount of responsibility to tell the stories of these people who got involved, because, as you suggested, many of the things were not reported. So I felt like the things that they contributed to the debate and to the opposition needed to be memorialized somewhere so that people could understand how this occurred.
I think you've done an enormous service in that regard. I mean, and I could, and also incidentally, you know, as long as we're sharing, I too met Al Perry because I was on a similar panel at Chapel Hill where he was on, and another representative of the entertainment industry. along with Mark Emerickson. And I had the same, incidentally, the same impression of Al Perry as you did, that I found him, even though we disagreed on the policy, and I was there as a representative of those who were opposed to SOPA and PIPA, I also found him very reasonable and someone who, you know, had an open mind and with whom you could have a honest disagreement on how to approach things. So I share that experience. Let's talk a little bit. I want to come back in shortly to these interviews and the stories that you heard and were told and what of those you found particularly surprising. But before we go there, and I want to make sure that I don't want to lose any listeners who are not familiar with this issue. So if you would give us the brief but sufficiently detailed overview of what SOPA was, what it purported to be, and briefly the history of that legislation.
Well, it was a continuation of a debate in Congress to increase enforcement mechanisms to combat online piracy of copyrighted works, as well as counterfeit trademark goods online. And the debate started around 2010, and there was a prior bill in the Senate. And then eventually, the bills that were considered, you referred to them before, PIPA and SOPA, were introduced in 2011. And I'll just kind of simplify things in terms of the main parts of the bills. I would say there are two aspects of the bill that turned out to be the ones that drew the most attention, not only among lawyers, but also among the public. The first one was the most controversial provision, which was a provision that would have authorized what's called domain name blocking. Basically, what it would do, this provision, it would give the Attorney General of the United States the power to go to court and based on a showing that there was some rogue foreign website out there. So the bills were targeting websites that were registered in foreign jurisdictions. So they were not registered in the United States with GoDaddy, for instance. And if the Attorney General, under this first provision for domain name blocking, presented sufficient evidence to the court that this foreign website was engaged in criminal copyright infringement, infringement of a certain value and done willfully, then the court could issue a temporary restraining order, a preliminary injunction, a permanent injunction against the site, even though there would be high likelihood that no attorney or no representative for the foreign website would actually be in court to contest it, because the bill allowed the Attorney General to go against what's called in rem, against the property, as a kind of a legal fiction, if the person owning the registration to the website domain name was not present in the United States. And we have actually another provision in law that already authorizes in rem seizure of domestic domain names with a similar kind of approach. So in any event, the SOPA bill would have authorized the Attorney General to go to court, proceed against the website, this foreign website, and then get a court order, and with that court order could instruct Internet service providers in the United States to block that foreign domain name. By one means would be to cutting off the domain name from its IP address, its unique IP address. It's somewhat akin to having your phone number disconnected so that the domain name does not mean anything anymore, that it becomes meaningless on the web. And people in the United States, if that happened and they were using that domain name, would not be able to find the website by that domain name that it's known by. And that provision was the most controversial because many of the critics argued there were just too few procedural safeguards, not only because it would be very likely that there wouldn't be an adversarial process where there would be a defendant or defendant's attorney contesting the Attorney General's showing, but also because the statute itself seemed not to have a very high standard to qualify for instance, a preliminary injunction to shut down the website based on a showing of likelihood of success on the merits. So that was one challenge, and people feared that there would be websites taken down indiscriminately, and there would be a lot of collateral damage with websites being taken down that were legitimate. But because of the process, it was kind of a very minor safeguards built into SOPA that there would be a lot of collateral damage. So that's the first provision. The other provision was a provision that would have authorized copyright owners to go after these foreign, allegedly rogue foreign websites engaged in criminal copyright piracy, and to, based on a sort of a notice similar to the DMCA notice and takedown, for those of you who are familiar with that, based on a notice to be able to direct financial services like PayPal and ad services like Google Ads to cut off the financial and ad services to a site that is allegedly engaged in criminal copyright piracy. Now, this provision turned out to be less controversial in terms of the protests and the opposition, although it too was attacked as not having enough procedural safeguards built into it to avoid indiscriminate shutting down of financial and ad services that, for a startup company, for instance, could be business ending if that happened. You know, if you were shut down for even 5 days, let's say, what would that do to your startup business? But the main provision that drew the most controversy was the domain name blocking feature. It's a technique that is used by China, Iran, and a few other countries to control access to material online. And the sort of rhetoric that was used at this time, many people thought that the SOPA bill was authorizing a form of censorship in the United States.
We're chatting with Ed Lee of IIT Chicago Kent on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, Ed, you do a terrific job in telling the story, which I want to get into, and I'm confident that your work will be one that's in as you intend, scholars will cite later in assessing what the facts are here. But I'm curious if, despite that, and you are doing this foundational work, if you have a thesis of sorts, and that's a pretty academic question, but I'm curious, you know, aside from telling the story, what are your other, if any, goals in writing this piece?
Well, I think for this book, my main goal was to tell the history of what had happened and how it happened. And then my sort of soft thesis is to respond to the media portrayal of what had happened in the SOPA debate, where it was very common in the national news networks on television, as well as in national media publications and newspapers, to portray what had happened with the Wikipedia blackout and the protests against SOPA as a battle between Hollywood and Silicon Valley. And that was, you know, basically the two giants coming together, and you know, in some respect, the victory went to Silicon Valley. Internet companies were against SOPA and they had won, was the story that you can see over and over again told at that time. So I guess in terms of, you know, what is my thesis was that that portrayal of what had happened is inaccurate, and what had happened was much more decentralized in terms of the opposition and involved many more players than Silicon Valley tech companies, and it involved, you know, millions of people who eventually got involved in various ways that were not necessarily coordinated. It was just an open season of trying to figure out what's the best way to protest this bill. And in my book, you know, I try to talk about some of the key players who I interviewed. But to be honest, there were so many more people who got involved who did amazing things that my book can't capture everybody's participation in the protests. So the basic thesis is that the victory should go to, I think the internet collectively as a whole, not just Silicon Valley, but the internet community, individuals who got involved, internet activists, and just, average everyday people who maybe for the first time in their lives actually got involved in a public policy debate before Congress. And I think that's the important story that needs to be told about what had happened in the ACTA debate.
And I'll tell you, I mean, from that perspective, and I want to kind of talk about what we can take from that battle today, particularly given what I have perceived as kind of the offloading of IP policy work from the domestic stage and the international stage. And I'll ask you about that too, about whether SOPA and PIPA perhaps can be, and I'll put it differently, blamed for that move. But I can certainly, on a personal level, attest to the fact that, at least in my own small world, that there wasn't a lot of coordination. I was frankly reading back and forth on the IP professors listserv about this bill back in 11, I guess it was, and early 11, and thought, why aren't IP professors speaking up on this? And that's when I contacted Mark Limley and David Post, and there was no other that was the coordination, which is what I want to talk about now, because you draw at the beginning of the book an interesting analogy to the story and perhaps myth of Paul Revere's ride. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about that and the parallel, if you will, in our understanding of Paul Revere and how he did what he did.
Yeah, what's great about obviously Paul Revere is a mythical figure, and every school child in America learns about Paul Revere. But there's a historian, David Hackett Fisher, who's written this incredible book about Paul Revere's ride, and basically Professor Fisher debunks this story about Paul Revere and how it's often attributed to Paul Revere alone that he warned Americans at the start of the American Revolution that the British were coming. The British are coming. By the way, Americans were British at the time, so it was probably more likely, he said, the regulars are coming. But in any event, the book about Paul Revere's ride by Professor Fisher describes how many people got involved to warn others in America about the incoming British troops. And when I first uncovered this reading Professor Fisher's book, I was just struck how similar that story was to what had happened in the SOPA protests. How, I think by a natural inclination, a human kind of inclination, we want to retell stories where there are heroes. And in doing so, it's often the case we leave out other people in order to tell the story of the hero. So Paul Revere became a hero in large part because a poet, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, wrote a poem that became basically study material for school children in America nearly a century after the events occurred. And that sort of meme or myth, was passed down from generation to generation. And, we've now, with the work of historians, to remind us, well, wait a second, it wasn't just Paul Revere. It was many other writers and many other people in the communities of primarily Massachusetts who got involved and who made it so effective in terms of the response against the British troops. And, the part that struck me the most, the part that I really got excited about when I read it, was that Fisher points out that the key to the American system of communication was the fact that it was a decentralized network. It was in stark contrast to the British system in America, which was completely centralized. It was a top-down model with a General Gage sending out a message to one other member of the British Army, but with the American system of communication, it was totally open, decentralized. People did what they could think of in terms of sounding the alarm, and they did so in many different ways. And you know, that struck me as exactly what happened in the SOPA protests, is that people were sounding the alarm in so many different ways. And I think the late Aaron Swartz said it best, is that the internet really is out of control in that respect. And that's, you know, people, so many people got involved. And as Swartz put it, people became the heroes of their own stories. And they did whatever they could think of to do to, you know, protest SOPA and to sound the alarm about this bill.
We're chatting with Professor Ed Lee of IIT Chicago Kent Law School on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on donate. Regardless, I hope that you continue to keep listening to both Hearsay Culture and KZSU. So before we kind of get into some of these really unbelievable stories, and like I said, I wasn't aware of them, which is why I'm thrilled to have you on. Give us a general, having given what you just said, it may not be possible, but I'll ask anyway, a general sense of the sides here. In other words, if recognizing the many players, and I'll say the caveat again that you can't possibly name all of them, although you've done a pretty impressive job in identifying a lot of people and entities. Roughly speaking, in terms of interest, how did the lay of the land fall? Who was on the pro-SOPA side, aside from the obvious players, and who were opposed to it?
Well, on the side supporting SOPA, you had the entertainment industry, Hollywood, RIAA, MPAA, but you also had other players that maybe were less frequently involved in copyright debates, because there was also this counterfeit trademark part of the bill. So you had pharma, for instance, involved on the side, you know, for SOPA, GE. You also had Visa, MasterCard. Even AFL-CIO was on board, I think in part because this bill was touted as a bill to protect jobs for Americans because of the asserted losses due to piracy and counterfeiting caused by some of these online rogue sites, so to speak. So that's, you know, basically you had a lot of corporations on the side of, from the entertainment industry and these other industries, on the side of SOPA. And then the other side, as I already mentioned, you had primarily tech companies from Silicon Valley. You had Google, you had Mozilla, and you had a number of other tech companies like Yahoo that were against SOPA for fear that it would not only create difficult, if not impossible, burdens for those companies to satisfy under the standards of SOPA, but also that it was potentially, in their view, fundamentally changing the structure of the internet and encouraging, you know, a more balkanized internet with United States cutting off foreign domain names sort of unilaterally. So that was, I think, a concern articulated by the tech companies. You also had a bunch of venture capitalists from Silicon Valley who were strongly against this bill, saying it was bad for innovation and further investment in internet companies of the future in the United States. And then you had, you know, a lot of, I would say, internet activists and internet nonprofits like EFF. You had academics, you know, law professors like the law professors that joined you in that letter. And then you had, I think, just beyond that, you had eventually a lot of regular people taking sides in this debate, and usually on the side against SOPA. for fear of, I think, some of the censorship concerns.
So there's a lot in the book from the you know, how we got here perspective, and I'll ask you a couple of questions there. First, and this is certainly ear-catching radio, explain to us the role of Justin Bieber. We're recording on January 29th, 2014, so he's been in the news recently for both illegal and also immature behavior. What I think many people might not be familiar with, the role of Justin Bieber in the SOPA story? And then the follow-up question will just be to share your most surprising story that you learned in conducting the interviews for the book.
Yeah, the Justin Bieber, who's been in the news last week, being arrested, it's kind of ironic that he was put in jail for a little bit, because it actually sort of was foreshadowed by this group that used him as a figure in their protest. So there was a small nonprofit called Fight for the Future, and it was composed of only four individuals, and they came together basically to stop SOPA. That was their mission. They were sort of strong internet freedom activists, and they thought that SOPA was a serious threat. So they got involved and set up this nonprofit. And the very first campaign they came up with was called Free Bieber. That's why I say it's kind of ironic, Justin Bieber's jailing last week.
Right.
Their campaign was called Free Bieber, and they launched it back in October of 2011.
Very prescient of them.
What's that?
Yeah, I said they very prescient. They kind of saw where this was headed.
Well, it's funny. They actually have a photoshopped picture of him behind bars in a jail outfit. Sort of like the orange is the new black. They have him in the orange jail outfit. But the basic idea behind the protest and using Bieber as a symbol was that there was another feature of SOPA that would have criminalized unauthorized streaming of copyrighted material of a value of $1,000 or more if done willfully. And I don't know if people out there realize how Justin Bieber got discovered. He basically started singing other people's music and recording that and posting them videos on YouTube. And he probably didn't have copyright permissions or licenses. He was only 12 when he started, you know, singing other people's music and doing, you know, posting the YouTube videos. And eventually, you know, he got discovered, and the rest is kind of history. But the idea of this Fight for the Future group was that Bieber himself would have been committing a crime based on that activity, and therefore we needed to free Bieber, and the Fight for the Future group asked people to sign a petition, and they eventually got 200,000 signatures in 1 week of launching the petition for an unknown nonprofit. That's incredible. Right. How do you do that? How do you get 200,000 signatures? Well, it turned out there was a DJ in Washington, D.C., who happened to have Justin Bieber for an interview that week. And apparently Fox News had reported something about this Bieber aspect of the bill, and that caught the attention of this DJ who, you know, being in D.C., where there's a lot of discussion of the politics behind SOPA, he asked Bieber this question: what do you think about this bill? And when he described it to Bieber based on this Fox News report, you know, Bieber said, this bill is ridiculous. And he said that the bill's sponsor should be locked up and put away in handcuffs. And that drove a huge amount of traffic to the petition for Free Bieber and got a lot of signatures. And it also drew national media attention. And that also got the Bieber fan sites involved in the debate. And so there were a lot of so-called believers talking about, you know, this so-called Bieber bill, and they were worried that what Bieber did was criminal. And so it just shows you, I think, in terms of some of the power of social media, as well as the ingenuity of some of the members of the opposition to come up with these campaigns that became viral almost overnight. I mean, it's really remarkable.
It is amazing, and you know the unsung hero that is Justin Bieber in this story. That's a pretty amazing story right there. But given the interviews you did, is there a story that jumps out at you as one where you did a double take, or you were surprised to discover this unreported information?
Well, I think the thing that I was most impressed by was the connection between SOPA, the SOPA protests, and the protests that occurred in the European Union. So there was another set of protests that occurred shortly after the SOPA protests in all 27 countries of the EU. And that was to protest what was called ACTA, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement. It was basically a trade bill that the US, EU, Japan, and other primarily developed countries were trying to formulate to combat also online piracy and counterfeit goods. So there was a part of the ACTA that had tighter regulations for the internet and providing effective enforcement of copyrights and trademarks against infringing works and goods online. And the part that surprised me was that there was actually a very direct connection between the two, and only afterward in studying other protests that occurred in the Arab Spring did I kind of realize that maybe I shouldn't have been so surprised. But one thing that ended up happening was that the timing of events helped to catalyze protests in the EU. So the Wikipedia blackout occurred on January 18th, 2012. Within a 24-hour period, there was a key meeting in Poland of a group with the government to discuss the fact that Poland was signing ACTA, this trade agreement, without public consultations. And that really was a surprise to the people in the room, and that really inflamed their fears that this bill, this trade agreement, was being basically decided without sort of a democratic process. And then what ended up happening was that there were protests in Poland in 50 cities a few days later. So in part, what happened was the narrative of the Wikipedia blackout was reported in Poland in the same narrative or articles that reported the Polish government's decision to sign this controversial trade agreement. And because they were wrapped together in the portrayal in the media, as well as because I also think that internet activists and NGOs commonly drew comparisons between the two, even though technically speaking, they were not, they didn't have the same components. They were different. But the timing of events just made it so that it was kind of the perfect storm for internet protests. And then eventually, within a month, all 27 countries of the EU protested, and it had over 100,000 people marching in the streets in the middle of winter. It was just awesome. I mean, no matter what side you're on, just to see what had happened in terms of how people got involved, I think it's quite impressive, whether you think they were right or wrong in what they were doing. But, it actually got people to take notice and state their view about this trade agreement.
We're chatting with Professor Ed Lee, author of the book The Fight for the Future, How People Defeated Hollywood and Saved the Internet for Now. The book is available on Amazon. It's also available at Ed's website, which we'll mention at the end of the show. You know, the ACTA debate and battle I was also involved with. I guess I should offer that disclaimer as well. Also involved in writing professor letters and getting involved there. And, you know, that battle went back really to, 2009, 2010. Now here we are in 2014, and we're still dealing with international IP issues. And in fact, international IP, as I mentioned earlier, at least to me, has now become really the new front lines for dealing with IP, intellectual property, and technology policy. And I'm curious to get your perspective on that. I mean, and you know, focusing on the events and really kind of the politics of it, what's your sense of how much currency international IP law issues have today in light of SOPA and PIPA? Because I will tell you, being involved in those issues personally, I think this stuff is still largely off the radar screen. At least that's my perspective, but what's yours?
I agree entirely. And I think it might apply even more broadly to just even domestic debates over copyright or trademark law or other IP law. And that's one of the challenges, I think, that the internet community faces in terms of trying to protect internet freedoms. I think it's really quite difficult to sustain attention of millions of people on some of the proposals that are being debated, especially in the international context in which most of the drafts are secret. They're not shared with the public until the very end of the process, so there's very little room for public participation. So it remains off the radar screen, I think, for a number of reasons, including sort of like, how do you keep attention of people over time? The SOPA debate, can the ACTA debate and the oppositions ever be repeated? You know, I think that's a legitimate question to ask. We haven't seen the same level of, I think, public involvement and outrage as we did then with now the NSA controversy, NSA surveillance controversy, mm-hmm. even though there are a lot of people in the internet community who are sort of up in arms about it. We have yet to see the mass public participation in this debate. And I don't have an easy answer in like saying, how do you actually sustain a social movement of this kind? But I think in part it will involve several layers of advocates trying to protect internet freedoms. So the issue that you raise with international IP agreements or trade agreements, you know, there is a fair amount of debate going on in Congress, and you know, Senator Ron Wyden has been one of the leaders in trying to provide greater oversight to check the executive in negotiating some of these trade bills, so that it isn't simply the executive signing a trade agreement that ultimately Congress has to implement if, you know, we want to protect our trade interests. So I think that would be a positive development, and it may be that we don't necessarily need to have public involvement in every single battle related to intellectual property, free speech, internet freedoms, or what have you. But at some point in time, I think there's going to be another issue where in order to evaluate it, in order to have, I think, the proper result, we will require the sort of mass public participation as we saw before. And I think the hard question is, can that ever occur again? You know, I'm not sure it can, but I'm hopeful that it can, but I'm not sure it can.
So let me ask you this, Ed, and we have about 10 minutes or so left on the show, maybe about 12. We get into what I call the unfair portion of the show, where I start asking questions that you may feel you don't have adequate time to answer. But then by fiat, I ask the questions anyway. So here we go with the unfair portion of the show. Okay. One of the interesting aspects of this story that you, in fact, you devote the better part of a chapter to, is this phrase, bring in the nerds. It's one that, and incidentally, kudos for using that phrase. I used it as well in an article on this topic that I published a few years ago. Bring in the nerds, of course, being a reference to what is now, at least within the world of SOPA, and I'd say even broadly IP kind of issues, a somewhat famous phrase from Representative Jason Chaffetz from Utah, who lamented the fact that in one of the congressional markup hearings on the bill that the members really didn't understand the technology, and yet were going to be writing and voting on this legislation. And the interesting thing, that at least to me, that came out of it was that more than one member, although sadly one member from North Carolina, Mel Watt, almost enjoyed the fact. And certainly made light of the fact and joked about the fact that they didn't know the technology and made it, I think, quite clear that they weren't interested in learning about it. And I'm curious again to get your take on that issue, on Congress's lack of understanding of the Internet. I mean, is that something that we should expect and tolerate? Can congressional staff compensate for the lack of understanding of elected members? I mean, what's your take on the whole bring in the nerds problem as it existed then and whether it exists now?
Well, I think it was certainly an important part of the opposition to SOPA that there were these internet engineers who were saying basically domain name blocking is incompatible with the new protocol, more secure protocol for the internet called DNS security. So what the federal government was funding that effort to make the internet more secure from cyber attacks with a protocol called DNS security, and internet engineers have been working on it for a number of years funded by the federal government, and some of them actually helped create the internet. So they spoke up and they said, well, wait a second, this SOPA domain name blocking seems to be, you know, totally antithetical to what we're trying to achieve by creating these IP addresses that are sort of cut off from their domain names, where you would not have a unique domain name or a unique IP address for every domain name. And I think what you referred to in Congress probably should be expected. You know, our Congress members should not be experts of the internet. And at the same time, I think when they're not experts and they're trying to regulate the internet or some other field of technology, well, they need to bring in the experts. And I think that's what Representative Chaffetz was trying to say when he said, you know, we haven't had the doctors in the room and we're trying to perform major surgery on the internet. Another funny line was from, John Stewart. He also reported this part about the hearings where they were basically that Congress members were taking delight in not being a nerd and not knowing anything about the internet, technically speaking, the technology of the internet. And they were imposing this domain name blocking feature that would, in the views of many internet engineers, sort of sabotage the government's effort to make the internet more secure from cyber attacks. So, I mean, I think the lesson to be learned from this incident is if you are attempting to change the structure or design of the internet and the domain name system, you've got to bring in the experts to opine on that proposal. You can't simply take it on faith that this won't screw up the internet. And I think the objections of Representative Chaffetz and others saying that, well, we need to have a hearing where we actually bring in some of these internet engineers to tell us why they think this is a problem, or even find other internet engineers who say this is not a problem. And I think always, at least in my view, it's better that Congress base its decisions on the best available information as opposed to sort of putting their heads in the sand and just thinking or hoping or praying that this won't screw up the internet, as I think that's how John Stewart put it.
So let me ask you this, Ed. I mean, I'll take kind of the opposite position on this. Is it a fair critique of this problem? And the problem now that I'm focusing on is really information available to policymakers, at least with regard to SOPA and PIPA, because the secrecy around TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, is kind of a separate issue and one I want to put aside for purposes of this discussion. Really focusing on SOPA and PIPA, you know, how well does the scientific and engineering community do in explaining these issues to non-experts? In other words, to put it differently, is there anything to be said for the critique that that engineers and scientists themselves could have done a better job explaining these issues to elected officials, and that therefore they are partially, if you will, responsible for Soap and Pippa having gone as far as they did?
Well, I guess I would disagree with that. There were five internet engineers who issued an important white paper in May of 2010, or actually 2011, excuse me, I think. 2010 or 2011, very early on in the debate, attacking this proposal for domain name blocking for the very reason that I just described. And that memo was widely shared. It's very accessible. It's online right now if you want to Google it and read it. It's very accessible. It's very short as well. Dan Kaminsky, Paul Bixie, and three others wrote that, co-authored that white paper, and it helped to get them interviews with staffers in Congress as well as members of Congress, as well as with the White House, because of this concern. So I would disagree with the characterization that they didn't do a good job explaining the problem. I think they explained the problem very well from the start, and you can tell by the impact it had with members of Congress and with the White House. I mean, otherwise, they wouldn't have been, I think, asked to appear in these meetings to sort of articulate more their views and explain more why they thought this was a problem for the internet if there was a domain name blocking feature. And I just think in terms of go back to the first question one of the first questions we talked about, it just shows, you know, the sort of the decentralized nature of this opposition and the protests, how, you know, various people got involved. It wasn't coordinated. Much of it wasn't coordinated, I should say. And it just, like, people came up and they just articulated their objection, and in ways very big and very small, it ended up having an impact in the end. And I think, you know, that's the lesson that I wanted to tell in this book.
So let me ask you this, Ed, in closing, we obviously could go quite a bit longer here, but your book, The Fight for the Future, How People Defeated Hollywood and Saved the Internet for Now, to really close our discussion, and it ties into the last pushback question I asked. We're recording on January 29, 2014. For all I know, while we're recording the show, more documents that were shared by Edward Snowden have been published and discussed in the news. This is an ongoing story. But a similar kind of, you know, question that I just asked, you know, given what is now a very complex story about technological capabilities of the intelligence community and how information flows through the internet, and you've got all kinds of very technical, really difficult computer engineering concepts that are being bandied about. You know, my sense is that a lot of people, even people that are interested in following this story, are having a hard time doing it simply because the technology is complicated. And then aside from that, there are others who might just say, look, you know, our privacy is out the window anyway. And, you know, so the fact that the NSA is doing this because they want to shut down terrorists, I guess I can live with that. My question for you along those lines is, are there any lessons or implications that we can draw from the experience in SOPA with regard to the NSA story? Now, the White House has recently, you know, proposed some reforms, and obviously there's been, you know, I think a lot more top-level attention to this story early on. Perhaps it impacts more people directly, but at any rate, I don't want to answer the question I just posed to you. In the next, you know, minute or two, again, unfair question, what implications would you draw from the SOPA and PIPA battle in terms of these core questions?
Well, I think the NSA controversy actually provides somewhat of a cautionary tale to the maybe more utopian kind of belief that the internet community or the internet itself will sort of achieve internet freedom, you know, very soon because of the SOPA victory, because of the Acton victory, that this will be an easy fight and it'll be something that the mass public stays involved, you know, of that high level that it was in the SOPA debate. And I think in the NSA controversy, well, one thing I should qualify it by saying that privacy, I think the privacy interests, may have a different kind of visceral spark a different kind of visceral reaction among people than the censorship concern. So that may help explain why there hasn't been as large a public outcry as there was for SOPA. But to go back to my basic answer to your question, I think the NSA controversy shows that, you know, these issues related to online privacy or internet freedoms are ones that will require a lot of participation of various actors. And in this debate, what's, I think a little bit reassuring is to see that over time, more and more Americans have recognized the importance of the debate. So I think a recent poll last week, a majority of Americans said that they were glad to have learned about the NSA surveillance program. But you're right, you know, there's a lot of technical things that are happening with the various programs with bulk data collection through PRISM and other various programs in NSA. And I don't think we should expect that all Americans or even the majority of Americans will understand or will have the time to understand all right. of those various programs. But I think that the key is that the information should be that's already publicly available should be scrutinized. And we've already seen, and President Obama, to his credit, has already undertaken efforts to reform the program to provide greater checks and balances. And also Congress is considering possible reforms to the FISA Act and the Patriot Act to control what the NSA can do. So this may be an instance in which we don't need the mass public to get so heavily involved as the SOPA debate was. But, you know, obviously I think it would be nice for our democracy that people do stay involved with these very important public debates. But at least in this, you know, issue, the debate has proceeded forward where President Obama actually has come out with specific reforms that he's proposed.
Ed Lee, Professor Ed Lee, author of the book, The Fight for the Future, How People Defeated Hollywood and Saved the Internet for Now. Again, Ed, I mentioned the book is available on Amazon, but for those that want to get an alternate copy of this book and to learn more about your work, where can they go?
They can go to my website, and they can go to it's called thefightforthefuture.com, and it provides a bunch of information about where you can buy the book. You can download a free copy of the book from the site as well under a Creative Commons license. And I also have several book talks coming up, and you can check them out where I'll be speaking.
Ed, thank you much for joining us on Hearsay Culture. Terrific discussion. You're invited back to continue the discussion down the road.
Thanks so much, Dave, and happy Lunar New Year.
thank you, sir, and to you as well. Very quickly, there are a number of great guests coming up this quarter, which has really just begun here on KZSU. Very, very quickly. Next week, Ethan Zuckerman, the director of the Center for Civic Media at MIT and the author of Rewire, Digital Cosmopolitans and the Age of Connection. After Ethan, Professor Susan Sell of the Elliott School of International Affairs at GW on International Relations and Transparency. Discussing NSA directly, Professor Peter Swire from Georgia Tech, who is one of the members of the President's review panel, will be discussing the review panel and the recommendations of the panel on that show. Professor Orly Lobel from the University of San Diego, author of Talent Wants to Be Free. Professor Mark Lemley from Stanford on the pending U.S. Supreme Court and IP cases. Professor Jennifer Urban of Berkeley Law on intellectual property litigation and the current clinical projects coming out of Berkeley. And to close out this quarter, Ivan Krastev of the Center for Liberal Strategies in Bulgaria, author of the book In Mistrust We Trust, Can Democracy Survive When We Don't Trust Our Leaders? As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen this quarter at 3 p.m. Pacific Time on Wednesdays on on KZSU, or you can pick up the podcast afterwards by going to hearsayculture.com, by going to Stanford iTunes webpage, and by going to the webpage for Stanford CIS at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Thank you much for listening today. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.